our Bibles and turn there. If you have your outline, I want to remind you just for the last time now that we are right in the middle. Actually, we're going to finish tonight this section on, it's number four under the big letter A, Judah's present condition and future consequences. It's a long section beginning in verse 6 of chapter 2 and ending in the first verse of chapter 4. All right. I pointed out last week that chapter 3 begins with an indictment against the men in general. And then we had to leave off right where he takes the leaders to task, beginning in verse 12, I believe. Beginning in verse 13, actually. And then he takes the women to task after that. And interspersed with a little bit of each in each section there. Okay, so we are looking at chapter 3. The chapter is divided into two sections. First 15 verses have to do with the attitude of the people, and then the rest of the chapter has to do with their activities. In a nutshell. All right, that brings us then to the courtroom scene, and you can see that it shifts again. Isaiah does this a lot, these courtroom scenes, beginning in verse 13. Notice the Lord standeth up to plead and standeth to judge the people. He's both the prosecutor and the judge in this case, and you don't want to have him being both of those, believe me. So by a solemn announcement of judgment, the prophet assures that Jehovah God is indeed preparing himself to come in judgment on the unfaithful leaders. And all of the prophecies, similar to those in verse 13, really should be taken literally. I'm mentioning that because many people do not feel that way. I feel they need to be taken literally and not as mere imagery and personification. Christ is presently sitting at the right hand of God, and the reason he's doing that, because he is the great high priest, he's indicating by that posture that he's resting after his cross work, after the labor and passion of his soul. Just as the same way he rested after creation, so he rests after the recreation. And of course that has to do with his being the ultimate great high priest. He's sitting to indicate his perfect, completed sacrifice, because that's what the high priest in the Old Testament was supposed to do. Actually, he was not allowed to sit down, ever. He had to perform all of his duties standing. And in the day of Christ's coming, however, he's going to stand up, and he will definitely do battle. Stephen, the martyr, the first martyr in Acts 7, and John, they didn't see him sitting. Both of them saw him standing, just as he will in the day of his coming. Notice the Lord standeth up to plead and standeth to judge the people. So notice he's going to take the leaders to task now. The leaders, notice they have two names in verse 14. They're called the ancients and the princes. And so what Isaiah is doing, he's comparing them with vermin that invade vineyards and people's yards and eat the vineyard of Israel bare. Now we're going to have to wait till chapter 5 where Isaiah goes into a long discussion using the metaphorical language of a vineyard to depict God's people Israel. But notice what he says in verse 14. The Lord, and notice all the capital letters, that's the covenant name of God, Jehovah. The Lord will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people and the princes thereof. The ancients, basically, in a nutshell, are those who were elected to posts or basically summoned or commissioned to take a post. And the princes are blood, those who rule by right of blood within the theocracy. Why? Why is he taking these people to task, to judgment? For ye have eaten up the vineyard. He's comparing them to mice to vermin, to rats. And then he says, the spoil of the poor is in your houses. You rob people. So they've plundered these empty houses of the wretched. They carry off the loot to their own palaces, and they crush the poor underfoot, and they mistreat them as though they were their slaves. Notice in 15, there you have another very expressive language. They grind the faces of the poor. He says in verse 15, what mean ye that ye beat my people to pieces and grind the faces of the poor, saith the Lord God of hosts. Grinding the faces of the poor, what is that? It's a very, very strong expression. It indicates that the poverty and despair was just written all over the face of these people. You can tell a face that's full of joy or ecstatic or excited, and you can equally just as easily tell a face that is in complete depression and total despair. And that was the face of these people. It could be read from the expressions on their face. And so the Lord himself is asking, what could possibly have come over these people to treat these poor people so miserably and so cruelly that they would invade their homes and steal their stuff? An astonishing thing that actually transpired. You have to remember now, Isaiah is telling exactly what he sees. He's not making stuff up, you see. So, just a staggering thing. That brings us to the last section in verses 16 and then right down to the first verse of chapter 4. Judah's fall essentially is the result of her pride, is what's going to be under discussion here. So he has depicted the judgment on the wicked leaders, both the elected and those who are leading by birth. They had become seducers and fundamentally oppressors of the people that they were supposed to be serving. Absolutely amazing section. Now describes the judgment, particularly on all of the attention here, and this is absolutely astounding. Now it shifts to the women, to the daughters of Israel. The worldliness of the time finds its greatest expression in the ways and the doings of the females. It's almost like you could hear the Apostle Paul. This is what I think Paul was aware of these passages. Now, he wasn't just aware of them. He studied them in fine detail. And so when he makes a statement like in Romans 1 that even their women did these things, that's kind of like the last straw, because the girls are supposed to be more refined than the men. And I think if you just observe life, you can probably know that just by living. Girls just seem to have a little more couth, a little more refinement to them than men do. And so when they go down the tubes, that's really the ultimate death knell on a civilization. Anyway, we get the impression here that these women exercised a really powerful, if not fateful, influence on the male leaders. That is the assumption. So the section now, verses 16 down through at least verse 23, it proves once more what a sharp observer and a literary artist Isaiah really was. And not without a hint of irony in which he just excels so well. He describes in the minutest detail the trappings of these highly suggestive women. And the passage, the beginning in verse 16, it's just astounding what he notices. Things that we just take for granted. I mean, things that you would never think. I mean, if we were writing the Bible, we wouldn't put this stuff in. That God, the slightest, most minutest detail, God noticed and then superintended the prophet to write down exactly the things that he saw. Things like how they stick their necks out, how they color their eyes. There's 21 things listed about how they just flaunted themselves. There'd be a feast, and they would just parade themselves down with suggestive looks and wear all kinds of stuff and actually make noises to draw attention to themselves. Let's go ahead and look at it. It's really an absolutely fascinating passage, to say the least. Someone said that today we need another Isaiah in view of the ever-increasing mania that serves the goddess of fashion. I personally don't think there's anything wrong with being well-dressed and looking appropriate and proper. But fashion has been taken to extremes, and that really is the issue that's being up for discussion here. Paris, London, Berlin, New York, L.A., all the great fashion centers of the world could care less what some new Isaiah might say. They wouldn't care any more than Jerusalem did when the real first Isaiah was up and walking around and preaching. Surely Isaiah himself would also say, what's needed is not an Isaiah, but the Lord himself. And that's what we need today. It shouldn't escape our attention that it was not merely Isaiah who saw and condemned all this. It was God. He's only reporting what God has noticed. And he sees the ways of men. And in the day of judgment, he's going to pronounce his irrevocable verdict on even the most minute details, which makes, again, this passage all the more shocking. He even pays attention to the little trinkets that were on their feet. They wore, you know what a castanet is? The girls walked around with these things on their feet. They were kind of like shoe buckles of some kind. And as they walked, you could hear the clanking, the tinkling of the bell. Verse 16. Notice, moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, that means they're proud, they're arrogant, and walk with stretched forth necks. You see this? Like this? God noticed it. It's unbelievable. And wanton eyes. The word wanton, the old English word wanton means sexually suggestive. walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet. And so they had these ornaments attached to their feet. And so God's anger was burning over this little minute detail. It was smoking against everything that really, I would have to say personally, that not sinful in itself. They were, but God saw what was behind the use of these things, this frivolity that laughs at the seriousness of life and leads to the wasting of time, not only your time, but God's, what God wants to do with you and the talents that he gave you, which is really a lot of what's going on in our modern culture. To be sure, there's many things that in themselves are absolutely not sinful, but God knows what's in the heart. He knows the infinite pride. He's not going to waste words. His words are not in error. He knows that man in his pride uses those things only for himself, wholly taken up with them, and he forgets the giver of all good and perfect gifts. And that's why God admonishes his people to lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily besets us. But of course, most people, even Christians, sometimes are just like these daughters of Zion that Isaiah is condemning, going all through life with all kinds of unnecessary burdens and superfluous luxuries that absolutely do nothing to enhance godliness. In fact, they're corrupting. And as far as the words for these articles of adornment are concerned, it's difficult to give the correct meaning of many of them. Now remember, the Bible that you're holding in your hands, the latest edition of the 1611 was done in 1769. There was never another edition done after 1769. So whatever these words meant in 1769... don't necessarily carry over into today, and we need to remember that. But let me just briefly call attention to basically the crux of the issue. And what Isaiah is doing is he sees that this proud, frivolous, women, these girls mincing in the streets of Jerusalem. And according to the original, what they're doing is they're enlarging their eyes, and they're putting black all around the eye. In verse 16, because the daughter of Zion are hardy and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes. It's a special word for eyes there that indicates what the ancients, what the Oriental women did with their eyes. They were very fond of you. They tried to get their eyes big, very, very big. The bigger, the better, because many times they were forced to walk around with veils. And so the only thing that sometimes showed was the eyes, you see. And they would make these black circles with a special kind of a pitch all around the eye. You see that today. You see these kids go into these grunge concerts, and they that's exactly the way that they look. It's the exact same thing. There's nothing new under the sun. And very frequently they would tear the eyelids, actually tear them so that they could make them even bigger, tear them apart for the purpose of letting this black, almost like a tattoo effect, so that it would stay in a permanent way, that this paste around their eyes. And the girls were different. Today's girl will powder, the whole face will be made up, you know, in a reasonable way. But the girls back then didn't do that. They didn't make up their whole face. They many times they were wearing veils. And so they would just kind of flaunt themselves past Isaiah. He's writing from his own personal experience, and these short, measured steps. And in order to do that more evenly, they would wear these small silver or gold chains around their ankles. That actually, because of the Oriental girl, maybe it's true even today. If you take too big of a step, that's not seductive enough. You see. You take the short, sexual type of step. And they had chains to govern exactly just how far that was. So it's they actually made themselves almost like prisoners of their own selves. The foot chains would make these tinkling sounds. And so the prophet reminds us of this kind of a walk. And the open and sometimes tinkling footwear of these women. In fact, this whole section basically shows that mankind in general is exactly the same today as they were in Isaiah's time. An amazing thing, really. Then in verse 17, the prophet calls out to the tinkling women that pass by him with these mincing steps, that the Lord is going to make their scalp scabby. God's going to bring baldness in place of wavy, flowing hair, and that he would then reveal their secret parts as the result of an unclean sickness. Look at verse 17. Therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. That phrase "secret parts" is almost all the time taken as a symbolic sense, as the dismantling of city walls and fortifications. But that can't be the meaning here, because the context won't allow for that. It has to be taken literally as a very cruel shame inflicted upon these women. Then notice in verse 18, the bravery of the tinkling ornaments about the feet. That refers to these shoe buckles, these tinkling shoe buckles. at least that's the opinion of a Jew named Isaac Leiser. That's how he understands the expression in verse 18. In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet and their calls. The call is a hairnet, I believe. Let me double check that. Some say it's a hairnet, some say it's a headband, I really don't know exactly what it was. But notice he also speaks about round tires like the moon. They would flaunt these crescent-shaped pendants as either earrings or they would hang them from some part of their anatomy. Their cauls and their round tires like the moon. Then in verse 19, notice the chains and the bracelets and the mufflers. What in the world are those things? The chains, some feel, now I don't know if this is true or not, I love to read the Jews, like Victor Buxbausen, wonderful commentary on the book of Isaiah. You know who Victor Buxbausen was? Buxbausen was the founder of the Friends of Israel. He's an amazing Jewish Christian. I love to read the Jews. The Jewish Christians are my favorite guys to read. Victor Buxbausen, David, the ancient David Baron, he's dead now. Zola Levitt, Arnold Fruchtenbaum. There's so many wonderful Jewish Christians that have made such a wonderful contribution. But Buxbausen and others feel that the chains were perfume boxes. I don't know how you get perfume boxes out of chain, but what Buxbausen says is that the root of the Hebrew word means to drip. And so he puts that together. And then the mufflers. The mufflers are veils, a type of veil that was worn to enhance beauty always in a suggestive way. And it's not just any kind of veil. It means literally glistening clothing, you see, a very beautiful type of veil. Then notice the second word in verse 20, the bonnets. is another reference. You know, we think of the Easter bonnet, you know, or a hat, but again, the Jews that know more about Hebrew than I do, they seem to think that it's another kind of a reference to the tinkling foot chains, you see. And then the headbands mean these ornamental sashes. And the tablets, again, that refers to these scent boxes or bottles of perfume. And then notice three kinds of rings are mentioned. There's actually earrings, finger rings, and nose rings in the second half of verse 20 down through verse 21. By the way, do you realize that most of the world's women and men consider nose rings to be very, very beautiful? They prefer nose rings to earrings? It's actually true. And you can see that they're mentioned. Isn't it astounding, friends? Some liberal will say, I wonder if the Holy Spirit has something else to write about besides the way women look. Well, I mean, that would be a pretty disrespectful way to look at it, but this is what God is writing about. Verse 22, the changeable suits of apparel and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, all adornments that these women were flaunting around in their everyday attire. So the changeable suits of apparel, very expensive. What's very high end clothing today? I don't even know. The word Dior comes to mind. I don't know, but that's what this was. Very expensive dresses, and various kinds of mantles and cloaks the last one there is purse. The crisping pins are the equivalent of a modern day purse, although it would have been a little bit different. And then in verse 23, the word glasses indicates transparent clothing. Can you imagine back in that day? I mean, we're talking about 2,700 years ago. See-through clothing. Now, I know they have that today, but they had it back 27 years ago also. And so here again, it looks like Isaiah was thinking of these, some of the stuff that's going on in our day and age. And then the fine linen refers to very, very, it's a reference to Victoria's Secret. Very highly expensive underclothing. Undoubtedly, the word refers to, they had a kind of a material that was interwoven with flax that was highly desirable, that people paid a fortune for. And then by hoods is meant these turbans, you know, which the girls considered to be very fashionable. Consisted of a wide strip of cloth wound around the head. And so at last, Isaiah has come to the end of the finery of these Jerusalem women. He names 21 things. 21 things that you would think are, man, that's for, obviously God cares about how these girls look. He really, really does. So it's almost as though with this enumeration of three groups of seven, he wants to just express the fullness of their unrighteousness. Hermeneutically, the number seven is a number of completeness. And there's three groups of seven. Ironically, just like in the book of Revelation, you've got three groups of seven plague. This is the way God consistently is using a hermeneutical pattern to display judgment. So by enumerating all these things piece by piece, he's not only ridiculing all their lasciviousness and their pride, he's also wishing, which I think is evident from what follows, to depict the really stark contrast between their the attitude that he saw in them right at that point and the things that were going to befall them in the future. And so in verses 24 through 26, he gives another set of sevens. And what we have here is seven contrasts, beginning in verse 24, and then 25 and 26. Notice the contrast. Instead of the sweet smell, what's going to happen to Israel in the future? What's going to happen to her ladies? Instead of the sweet smell of spices, there's going to be the stench of wounds and pus. Undoubtedly from the head sores that were mentioned back in verse 17. So these lewd women, they're going to be beaten, they're going to be mistreated as captured slaves, essentially. Notice, instead of a gorgeous girdle, there'll be a rope, a noose that you basically haul off prisoners with. It'll either be around their neck. Instead of having these wonderful, you know, gold-studded sashes, they're going to be hauled off like common slaves with a noose and be bound by that. The word's also translated by rent, ripped rags of blue welts. Then notice their waving hair is going to be cut off, which was the sign of captivity. That was the sign that you now were a slave. So instead of the beautiful flowing dress, they're going to put on sackcloth, which was the sign of mourning. And the word burning, that doesn't refer to sunburned or, you know, getting a tan or anything like that. The burnt mark of a branding iron is what's in view here. They would brand the slaves in various places. And then they're going to lose their men by the sword of war. And they're mighty men. These guys that they put their trust in are all going to fall in the battlefield. And so there's going to be this unbelievable mourning and wailing in that day. Here's the way Buxbaum puts verse 24. Instead of perfume, there'll be stench. Instead of a girdle, a rope. Instead of well-groomed hair, a bald head. Instead of a fine robe, a sack. Branding instead of beauty. Really a very expressive thing. So in that day, there's going to be just absolute nothing but mourning. Grief in the gates of Jerusalem and of Judah. And every one of these proud, haughty daughters, they're going to sit down on the earth, robbed and bereft and lonely and utterly forsaken. They're not going to no longer walk with these men's tinkling steps to beguile and seduce men. They're going to totally be crushed and they will bewail the men that are no longer with them or living with them, since they're all dead from the battle. You can see that in verse 25, thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty in the war. Both your husbands and the warriors are all going down, and you're going to be left alone. And so then the whole discussion ends in verse 1. Notice, in that day of chapter 4, in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. In other words, you don't have to take care of us. Just let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. So don't let the chapter division fool you. Verse 1 is actually the conclusion of the discussion. It's evident that the verse belongs to the condemnatory speech given to these wanton women at the end of chapter, all through the last half of chapter 3. These women are told that they're going to lose all their fashion and all their trappings in this judgment. And so here they're depicted as being desperate because of the shortage of men. There's no men left. The country's completely depopulated. Their young men and the soldiers, the bloom of the nation, they're all fallen in battle. And you have to keep in mind that in the ancient Near East, it was a disgrace for an Oriental woman, including a Jew, a Jewish woman, to not be married. Actually, that was a disgrace, and especially not to be childless. This is why Hannah begged for a child. Remember Hannah in 1 Samuel? And not just Hannah, but others as well. She died without having been married and having had children. She was convinced that she died a disgrace. There's many references in Scripture that actually hint at that. So notice what a long discourse on the depopulation of the country and the resulting perplexity of these women. just with one stroke of the pen there at the end in verse 1, he just puts the whole thing into a very visual perspective. This unbelievable scene. You got seven girls all together seizing one man, begging him to be their husband. And they make it as easy for him as possible. I mean, even the law demanded that a man was absolutely responsible to take care of his wife. That was written right in the Mosaic Law in Exodus 21, verse 10, Exodus 22, verse 16, Deuteronomy 22, 28, 1 Samuel 18, 20 through 22. In fact, remember, Hannah's husband said, haven't I been good to you? Haven't I taken care of everything? In other words, what he was saying is, didn't I obey the Mosaic Law? I understood Exodus 21 and Exodus 22 and Deuteronomy 22, you see. But these girls, they don't require any of that. In fact, just the opposite. They promise, they tell this one guy, we'll take care of ourselves. We'll find our own clothing, and we'll make sure that we get our own food. All we want is to be your wife so that we can have a name. And, I guess we're kind of, really what they were hoping for was some kind of protection, you see, because that was the major role of the husband. He was the number one protector of the girl. Actually, ironically, the number seven here indicates an incompleteness. It usually indicates completeness. Here it indicates incompleteness, and it's used here as it is in other places in both a negative and a positive sense. Now, there's no record of the exact fulfillment of this statement, except notice in verse 1, it says, in that day. What day? The day of the Lord. All right, so this is stuff that's going to happen in the tribulation. You're going to have a horde of girls clinging on to one guy begging for matrimony so that they can have some sense of security and escape the basic shame that all that these Oriental women are aware of. All right, whew, done with that. Then next week, we'll look at the glorious chapter on the branch, the wonderful things that God's going to do.